Welcome to the Brown Bagger here on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Most of us spend 90% of our time in buildings. Half the planet's population has moved into cities. Our building stock is ever increasing, exactly in a time of dwindling resources and heavy impact on the planet. One positive move is toward net zero buildings. You will hear a seminar given by Jamie DeSimone on March 13, 2010, at the Lighthouse Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver, Canada. Jamie describes a building project she did near Peterborough, Ontario, creating an environmental teaching center using wood and straw bale technology. This building of about 2,000 square feet is at Camp Kawartha. This recording has only been edited to remove questions from the audience during the presentation. There were no microphones for the audience. You don't want to hear 2 minutes of mumbling. So if Jamie seems to jump about occasionally, it is likely in response to audience feedback. Here is Jamie DeSimone.
Thanks for coming, guys. This is a really awesome turnout. I wasn't expecting it. Thank you so much. I come from Ontario. I just moved out here about 6 months ago to try and be a part of this wonderful green movement that Vancouver is so well known for. I come from a science background, environmental science, so I did an undergrad and a master's degree in environmental science. And I just wasn't really satisfied with the kind of research that I was doing. It was more really, I mean, you write papers and people read the papers and they're just, it's not very applicable to everyday life. And so I really wanted to get into something that really made a difference. And so I took a course, which I'll be talking to you about today, where we built this awesome building. So we built this great straw bale building, super sustainable, net zero energy. And so I'll go through all of that with you guys. And I just want to say that totally changed the way I think about buildings, the way I think about sustainability, and I think it was an amazing experience, and so that's definitely where my career is going, in the direction my career is going in. This is so encouraging. I love that everybody's so interested in natural building. That's awesome. Hopefully we can make some big changes here. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about the impacts of buildings, building materials and embodied energy, which is something we should really consider when we're putting together a building and choosing materials. And then the Camp Kawartha experience, that's the majority of the talk. So Stan, the first person that introduced himself, mentioned something about the impacts that we have here on the planet. I think right now, on average, we're taking up about 1.4 Earths. So we're obviously using way more than we should be using. And so we really have to consider building differently and changing the way that we see buildings and the way that we use them. So how much time of our lives do we North Americans spend in buildings? Anyone have a guess? A percentage? Absolutely. 90% of our lives we spend. That's huge. No, that's a really, really, really big number. Even, I mean, we live out in BC, a lot of people like to spend time hiking and camping and things like that, but the majority of us spend about 90% of our lives in buildings, and that's, when we see how much buildings and their occupants use of our natural resources, that's a huge number. So we use about 17% of the world's water resources, 25% lumber, 40% of our raw materials, and 54% of our energy. And so the population of the Earth has doubled in the past 45 years. So now we're almost at 7 billion. It used to be about 3.5 billion 45 years ago, and we're expected to double again in the next 50 years or so. So buildings already use so much, and we're building more, and there's more people on the planet, and so we really, really, really have to consider the way that we use them and what we're building with. So according to the UN, the world is undergoing the largest wave of urban growth in history. And so we have, as of 2008, more than half the world's population lives in towns and cities. And we're building them like concrete jungles, people often refer to. So we have a lot of impervious surfaces. We have a lot of water running off. We have a lot of pollution being caused. And arguably, water is the most important resource on the planet. Every single living organism needs water. And we're treating it really, really poorly, especially with the way that we build. So some of the consequences, referring specifically to water, of the current urban development are obviously taking up land resource and resources for growing food, and food security is a big issue right now. We have flooding, obviously. There's impervious surfaces. Water has nowhere to go but We also have stormwater management problems. So we have something called combined sewer overflow. A lot of cities, the municipalities, they have one tube for all of our sewage and stormwater to go through. And so when we have a huge storm flow, all of the stormwater and sewage water gets mixed up together. And if it's too much, then it bypasses the sewage treatment plant because there's too much water to go all the way through it. And that happens fairly often. And so all of that water, all that mix of water, all the pollution from the impervious surfaces, like the gas, the oil, everything that's on the ground that gets washed into the sewers, and also all of our sewage water just bypasses and it gets into our rivers, lakes, and streams. And according to some scientific measures, the most important pollution, or the strongest point of pollution in coastal environments is stormwater pollution. So that's obviously really important, especially here in Vancouver. So we've definitely interrupted our water balance in the way that we're building right now. And so this is just an example of how we've changed the water balance. So if we have one family home on a plot, we have 100% water coming down, and let's say 50% falls on the lawn, 30% falls on the roof, and 20% falls on their driveway surfaces, the paved surfaces. So if we consider runoff coefficients, we consider evapotranspiration, stuff like that, we have about 60% of that water running off. And instead of percolating into the ground, instead of being uptaken by plants and stuff, it's just going straight off into our sewers. If we convert our homes or build differently, so we build a little bit more green, we have maybe a green roof, we have rain water collection, rain barrels, rain gardens, things that can collect water and allow water to percolate and have pervious pavements as well, so water can actually infiltrate into the ground where it's supposed to go. We can reduce that to about 7%, which is a huge reduction, and it doesn't take very much to be able to do that. So that's also something we should consider when we're considering building. So buildings use up a lot of non-renewable or very slowly renewable materials, and we're only building more buildings as populations increase. So the consequences of unsustainable urban development can be really devastating, as we can see with floods and things like that. So I think really, the need for building sustainably is quite undeniable, and I don't really have to tell you guys that, but this is, you know, I'm kind of preaching to the choir, I think, right now, but it's important to talk about. So the term sustainability, it means meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And we often think about this in the environmental sphere and just talk about environmental sustainability, but I think what we really need to talk about as well is economic and social sustainability. And so when we have all these three spheres of sustainability actualized, this center portion where all three meet is where we can really achieve true sustainability. And this is also considered the triple bottom line. So when we're talking about materials that we're using for building, we can look at the life cycle of the materials. So we have raw material extraction, manufacture, transportation, assembly and installation, disassembly, deconstruction, and or hopefully decomposition. And so we call this the life cycle of material. We can also call it the cradle to cradle thing. So we're looking at how materials are manufactured and how they get back to the raw material point. And then we can also call this embodied energy. So we can do calculations of all these different parts of where a material comes from, and we can add a value to it and compare different materials based on this embodied energy value. And the value is a joule, so an energy per kilogram per mass. And this is an example of a table of a bunch of embodied energy values. So the building that we built, which I'll talk to you about, is a straw bale and has a really, really low embodied energy because it's a waste product from agriculture. So it's already being produced. It's really easy. It's really light. It's easy to transport. And it decomposes when you're done with it. So it's got a really good cradle-to-cradle system. And things that we use like aluminum, fiberglass, and polystyrene insulation, those have really high embodied energies. And paper even has a pretty high embodied energy, as well as PVC and HDP, which a lot of our piping and stuff is made from. No, it's the whole cycle of the... Yeah, it definitely includes that, yeah. Concrete, it's the most intensive part of... Not necessarily intensive, but concrete, the...
It requires a lot of energy.
The cement, Portland cement is...
It's
the greenhouse gas emissions, which the embodied energy doesn't take into account necessarily greenhouse gases. But you're right, Portland cement, 1 ton of Portland cement produced is 1 ton of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is ridiculous. So, yeah, that's definitely something to consider as well. So there's all kinds of things you need to look at, but it's overwhelming to look at everything that you can possibly look at. So this is just one possibility of a measure. So the project I'm going to talk about is the Camp Kawartha Education Center, Environmental Education Center. And the program, the school program, is through Fleming College, and it was called Sustainable Building Design and Construction. And basically we did just that. We built a building in about 4.5 months, and there were 26 of us, and each student had to choose 3 things that they were in charge of, one mechanical, one structural, and one administrative. That's it. So all of us had a task that we were responsible for and that we were in charge of doing. And this was an amazing course. I definitely recommend if anyone is interested in knowing a little bit more about sustainable building and natural building and actually get a hands-on idea of how it works. It was only 5 months, and it's in Ontario, unfortunately, but it's in a place called Peterborough, and it's easy to find places to live there for a couple of months, and it's an amazing, amazing, amazing place. And the teacher who teaches the course is like a straw bale guru. He wrote this book. If you guys are interested, it's More Straw Bale Building. He wrote also Straw Bale Building. This is the second one, Chris Magwood. This is something David Suzuki said about this building and about environmental education in general. And David Suzuki is one of my heroes. I love him. The great challenge of our time is to reconnect ourselves with the world around. It is the biosphere that is our home, and our most fundamental need is clean air, water, soil, and energy, and the diversity of life to deliver these basic needs. Most children today grow up in cities where we focus on the economy. We have to change this focus. I think he just hits the nail on the head there, absolutely. And so one of the things this building did for me was demystify building construction. I think that's a really, really important thing when we're talking about sustainability. We're talking about kind of being a part of your building. So, like, what's behind that wall? And now I have an idea what's behind that wall. And if I needed to fix something, I would have an idea of where to go and how to do it and what to look at. And I think that that's really important. I mean, we spend 90% of our lives in buildings, and a lot of that time is spent in our homes. So we're kind of like snails. We've got our houses on our backs. And I think it's important to think of buildings as kind of like an extension to ourselves. And if we do that, and if we understand the way buildings are built, and understand that they are a part of us, then I think that we'll treat building a little bit more differently, and we'll kind of make it more sustainable because we want to be more sustainable in our lives as well. So we're decreasing our footprint by decreasing the footprint of the building, the place that we live. So I encourage you to be a do-it-yourselfer. There's so many great books out there just to learn a little bit more about what you're doing. So these are some of the features of the building. There's lots. I'm going to go through all of these and a little bit more. So net zero energy design, supplying back to the grid at peak demand hours, grid-tied solar panel, passive solar design, prefabricated and built on-site straw bale walls, geothermal heating and cooling, radiant floor, living roof, solar hot water, rainwater collection, indoor constructed wetlands, straw bale, hempcrete, slip straw, and composting toilets. A lot of stuff, a lot of really great products that we used. So in terms of passive solar design, I know this is a really busy diagram, but I just want to point out a couple things here. So these are our floor plans, and if you see all the blue lines are the walls, and then where there's a break in the blue line, there's either a window or a door. So in the top part of your image, there's the round wall, and that's facing south, and then the bottom part is facing north. So there's 2 doors in the north and three small windows. And in the south, you see 2 large windows on either side, and then 5 windows in the round area. And so windows are obviously very important when you're talking about passive solar design. You want to have sun that comes into the building and that in the wintertime is able to heat up a thermal mass. So obviously it's very important to have a thermal mass in your home. And that will then radiate that heat, that energy back out in the evening time when the sun goes down and when it gets cooler outside. And the most important thing about passive solar design, because in the summertime it can get really hot if you have too much sun. So you really have to have a good overhang system or something that hangs over your windows in order to not get too much sun in during the daytime. So this building is the Environmental Education Center that we built, like 2 different classrooms at a time, and they can all come in, and there's a bunch of displays and stuff set up as well. So this is an example of a good passive solar design. So you have that overhang that stops the summer sun from coming in too far into the building. And then in the winter sun, because it's a lot lower in the sky, then it can penetrate into the building. And it heats up a thermal mass, which in this case, it's the floors. Our floors are concrete, about 2.5 inches of concrete, and that acts as a really good thermal mass. You can also have a wall that's a thicker wall against where the sunlight would come in, and that would act as a good thermal mass as well. So the foundation, I think this is one of the coolest parts of the building, and I think it's something that can be incorporated into conventional building, but Maybe I can get some answers from some people if they disagree with me. But so basically, we had a floating perimeter beam on a concrete on a gravel bed. The gravel bed is about a foot deep or so, maybe 14 inches, and we built a form. In the top right corner, you can see the form that goes around the perimeter. And we just poured the concrete in there. But before we did that, we added sonotubes, 6-inch sonotubes at 1-foot centers all the way along the concrete, or all the way along the form, and reinforced it all with rebar. And that was to displace about 35% of the concrete that we were pouring in there. Because right in the center portion, you don't need any concrete. It doesn't do anything for the stability of the structure. So it's wasteful to have it there, so we decided to totally displace it. And also, instead of using Portland cement, we used 50% slag, which is a byproduct from the steel industry, and it's just waste material. It works very similarly to Portland cement, and because it's a waste material, it's much more sustainable to use. So we were able to displace a lot of the Portland that we used. Yeah, it's the same thing, fly ash, yeah, exactly. Approximately, yeah. We just tamped it with a motorized tamper, went all the way around the whole thing. And so we made it, because we have a bunch of different wall systems, we made the width of the perimeter different at each different section of the building. We also used earth bag foundation, and I had never heard of it before, and I think it's such an amazing idea. Basically, we had these bags, like you can see in the top picture here, with it's like a rice bag almost, like a plastic weaved bag, and we just added a mixture of A gravel, a bit of slag, and some water. Just mixed it up in a mixer, and then you pour it in and you just tamp this down, and it creates a really, really strong, stable foundation. And we could have used it for the entire foundation of the building. The reason that we didn't was our teacher thought that it wouldn't be flat enough to put our prefabricated walls, which I'll show you in a second, that need a really flat surface. But it turned out that those were much flatter than the actual concrete that we used, and we had to come around with a hammer and a chisel to actually chisel the whole foundation. It was terrible. But anyways, I would definitely use earth bag foundation. It's amazing. And it's really good to do for round sides as well. So we stopped the perimeter beam at the round wall, and we use earth bag to do that instead.
A couple of things. Yep. When the bags degrade, is what's inside still staying together?
The bags don't degrade. That's one thing. They're not biodegradable.
The UV won't break them down?
They're covered. So, yeah, they're totally covered. And the UV probably would break it down, but it wouldn't be fast enough in the time that we're actually leaving them exposed. But they're fully covered once the building's finished. I can't remember how it was actually connected. I think that there was probably some wiring that was connecting it to each other, but no, there was no rebar. The walls above it would be tied together really well, so that might add something, but you're right. It probably would be need a little bit of... I'm sorry? There's no freezing. There would be, definitely. I mean, this is Peterborough, and it gets really cold in the wintertime, but because it's a gravel bed, there's no water that actually stays in the gravel because the pores are too big. So there's no problem with that. And underneath it, we have silver board that goes kind of slanting down from the foundation off, so any liquid that might be caught up in there would kind of fall down and fall away from the building. And then we had tiles, drainage tiles underneath to get the water out. Silverboard, sorry, that's... Yep, the whole foundation. And we did the round wall as well with it. Yeah, any foundation was surrounded by it for insulation.
So is that more for insulation?
That's for the insulation, yeah. So I just wanted to point out, we have a book downstairs called Earth Bag Building, and you can build entire structures out of earth bags as opposed to just the foundation. There's some really great... I'll just show you a quick image. Yeah, there's some really great stuff online as well. Well, anyways, this is what one of the buildings looks like. They make them into like a cone type shape. And you guys can... just A gravel, a bit of slag, and water. That's it. So another thing that we built, this was my task. I call them sustainable SIP panels. And SIP is a structural insulated panel. And we actually have some examples of those here. They're not the sustainable... Well, they are fairly sustainable, I shouldn't say that. But they're not made of straw bale. So if you just look Lane Fab, these walls here, they're SIPs. So basically you have two sections of plywood and then polystyrene or some sort of insulation in the middle of that. So instead of using plywood, we used lime cement plaster, and we used straw bales as the insulation in the middle. So this was our workshop, on the top. We had, it smelled like a barn. We just had a lot of bales, and we also had some wool in there that was just shaved off a sheep. So it was pretty stinky in there, but it was awesome. And we have, can you guys see? Yeah. So these are top, yep. Sorry, go ahead. So we have top and bottom plates that act as the structure for the top and bottom for the roof to be able to sit on top of, because these were going to be the load-bearing portion of the building, and they were going on the east and west walls, and there are four panels on each wall. And in between each of the panels, we built in, we did stick framing, just single frame stick framing, to put in windows and doors, because it's much easier to frame on site than it is to frame them into a prefabricated panel, and it takes a lot less waste, so it was much easier to do it this way. So the top and bottom panels are filled with, this one was filled with vermiculite on the bottom, and then sheep's wool on the top panel. And then, so we built a form, and on the sides of the form we had 2x6s that would stay in the form and that connect this panel to the stick frame next to it. And we filled it, the bottom, with the lime cement plaster, about 3/4 to 1 inch thick. And then we added in the straw bales on top of that. And the bales had to be buttered, we call them buttering, with this lime cement. So we just kind of put it on top and push it in so that we can make sure that there's a connection between the lime cement plaster and the bale when we put it into the frame. And the reason for that is because the lime cement, the 3/4 inch thick, is actually what is the sustaining part of the wall. That's what keeps the whole roof up. That is what keeps it up. And the straw bale is really just the insulation and a little bit of structure behind that. And then once it's filled, we have to go in and fill in all the really small little crevices, because that can really cause moisture damage and things like that. And you'll see it on the wall if you haven't filled in all those spots in a couple months when your building is up. And then we plaster it over top, and then it ends up looking like this. It's a very lovely looking slab of, looks like cement. And then they each weigh about 1 to 2 tons because of the lime cement plaster. So you have to have them brought in on a truck. There's this bottom plate that I showed you. There's the top and bottom plates stay on the wall. And then
what I'm seeing is
this surface.
Yeah, it looks like at the bottom.
Yeah, there is. And then once it gets put, that's just to hold in the plaster on the bottom of the structure, right? So once it gets put up on the wall, that gets unscrewed and taken off. A form, yeah, it's just a form, exactly.
But
so we
don't have it on it.
Well, because we wouldn't be able to plaster over
top of
it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, once we put it on the wall, on the foundation, we were able to take off that piece of the form and then use that for, we built 4 at a time, and we had 8 of them. So we built 4 once and then used the same forms to build the next 4. It's the plaster.
Just the plaster
yep.
itself.
Which is why we need to butter it first,
so
right, to make that bond.
Together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is structure in the straw, but it's... Yeah, there's no problem. We had really good engineers that were writing it off, and that's the key. You need to have a good engineer that can tell you that it's going to be okay. No, there aren't. Yeah, we were lucky enough to find one that really believes in this stuff and was really excited to be able to pass it on. But there's all kinds of studies, especially the University of Bath. They have the School of Civil Engineering and Architecture. They have some really great research projects that are looking especially at structural insulated panels like this. Straw bale panels, and they do fire ratings, they do stress tests, they do all kinds of stuff, and so there's lots of actual numbers out there that can tell you that they are perfectly acceptable just offsite. So this is this was something we talked about in class as being a potential for a little bit of a job startup. So you could market yourself as a straw bale SIP panel builder, and all you need is a big open space, and then you need someone to tell you what the dimensions are, and you could. Really, I mean, I'd never really even picked up a hammer before, and I built that. And it's pretty simple. You just need to have a good design, and you're good to go. And so someone can order a different size and make it, send it out to them, and that's it. They can put up their roof. And that's another really good thing. We wanted to have these done as soon as the foundation was done, because the roof was being built at the same time on the ground, and we were going to transfer the roof over, put it onto the building, and then we could build the other wall structures underneath the roof, because building a straw bale house without a roof is a really dumb idea if it rains, because you don't want the bales to be wet at all. That could cause a lot of problems. So, yeah, so this is a really good way of building it. So like I said, we built the roof on the ground. It went much faster than building it on the roof itself. And also, we didn't have any load-bearing walls to put the roof on just yet. So we were able to do a couple different things at the same time. So we got all the trusses in from the company, and I wasn't too involved in this because I was building the walls at the time, but they built this beautiful gable roof, and there's two sections. There's this gable part of it, and then there's also this flatter roof, which has a very low pitch, and that's the roof that we were putting the green roof on. And green roofs need a low pitch in order to...
You guys didn't actually...
We didn't build the trusses, no. We purchased them, and they came just lying flat on a truck, and then we put them together. And the roof is sheathed in steel. You can see on the bottom right-hand side. And that was because we were using rainwater as potable water in the building, and the most benign material is steel. So this is the roof being lifted over. It looked kind of like an alien ship moving over us when it was going on. It was really awesome. We can see kind of strings hanging down in the corner. So we had two students at each corner kind of moving the thing around as it was moving. It was a great experience. Very scary, but... Yeah, we do. Yeah, we have some videos. And then so at each point where there was going to be a truss sitting down, we had a student that was ready to, like, move it around if it needed to be moved around. So you can see everyone standing up there. It was a big process. Once it was done, it was such a great feeling. And so on top of the green roof, we had this EPDM rubber membrane, which is totally waterproof, and that goes right on the bottom of the plywood decking on top of the roof. And that was really, really, really heavy. And so we had to actually... I forgot to mention this, but there's two... These two walls are also load-bearing, and we needed those two walls load-bearing just under the green roof because the green roof was going to be so heavy with this EPDM membrane on it. We actually had to get a crane to come and lift it onto the roof because it was too heavy to do it manually. The rolls, yeah. So they were rolled out, and then we had crushed brick and manure and a bit of sand that we carted up in our little buckets. We had a little assembly line on the hottest day of the summer. It was totally crazy and uncomfortable, but we had, like, scaffolding set up, and we had a student on every different level of the scaffolding passing buckets up. And it took a really long time, but it was awesome once it was finished. And it's like a gravelly kind of crushed brick.
And
yeah. And it pore space, light in the soil. It has nutrients and minerals in it. And then we planted 10 different shade-tolerant plants. They were all native to the area. And including, I think there's wild strawberry up there as well, a bunch of different plants. And it doesn't, by the end of the summer, that's basically just what it looked like. Unfortunately, it hadn't really kind of grown up too much yet, but over the next summer, it'll really grow wild. It'll look like a meadow up there. We didn't have anything to adhere. It was really heavy, so it's not going to really go anywhere. But also, we built a retaining wall, a small retaining wall, all the way around the roof.
Yeah.
So that... A parapet, that's what it's called, yeah. So nothing could actually slide off, catch whatever there... Yeah, that's true. I mean, I haven't seen it this year. This was last summer, but they were meant to be drought-resistant and meant to be shade-resistant as well. So we'll see what happens in the summer, I guess.
This is the Tuesday Brown Bagger on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. You were listening to Jamie DeSimone, who was talking about environmentally friendly building, in fact, net zero buildings. She made one in Kawartha in the Peterborough area of Ontario, and now she's at the Lighthouse Sustainable Building Center talking to a seminar of interested people about how to make really low energy buildings using environmentally friendly building materials.
So wall insulation systems. Our teacher, when he was designing the building, wanted to do a whole bunch of systems so that we could learn all kinds of different ways of insulating and building. So it was really interesting, and there's a whole bunch of stuff. So we used hempcrete as one of them. And so we have hemp fibers in the top, and that's just a byproduct of hemp growing in agricultural purposes. And it's the same as straw, essentially. It's just from the hemp plant instead. And so we crushed up those hemp fibers and mixed it with lime and a little bit of water. You can see in the bottom right picture. And then we double stick framed a wall with a 1 foot space in between the two wall frames. And then we basically put plywood on either side like a form and just kind of stuffed in the hempcrete. Yeah, exactly. So it's easy to kind of pack down.
Yeah.
And we used like a wood mallet almost to just pack it in. Yeah. And then we can't pack it too much because then you'll lose a lot of your insulative ability because you need airspace in there. But, yeah, it was really easy to do.
It's totally hard when it's...
Yep. Yeah, like pretty much one. I mean, they were really only using two pieces of plywood, so they would put the plywood on the bottom, pack it in, and by the time they had packed that in, they could remove, like, unscrew the plywood and move it up, like, leapfrog it, and it was already set so that you wouldn't have to worry about it falling out of the wall or anything. Another system that we used is slip straw, which was put in exactly the same way, but slip straw is like using straw bales, except you kind of mix it up with a clay slip, like to the consistency of like Caesar salad-ish. That's the best way I can, with too much dressing, yeah. So we just used clay from a dig that had happened. One of the people that was helping us with the course, she knew someone that was doing a dig that found a whole bunch of clay in their site, and obviously nobody wants clay at their site, so they shipped it over to us. We had a whole big section of clay, and we just made a big pit and clay and water. That's pretty much it, a little bit of sand, and that was our slip, we called it. When you put your hand in, if you took it out, it looks like you're wearing a mud glove. That's kind of the consistency, like runny yogurt kind of thing. And so we dipped a whole bunch of open straw bales into this clay slip, and then we stuffed them into the wall in the same way that we did the hempcrete. And no, you don't want the bale intact. It's kind of, yeah, it's handfuls of it. You just stick it in.
Grass here?
We called it our chia wall. Nope, that's just grass growing on its own. It's because it's all coated in the slip, right? So it's really, and because we put plywood on either side, so when it's set, then it's going to be pretty straight. And so it was growing because there's liquid in there, there's a good place for the seeds to stick onto, there's some soil. And the reason that this is a really good thing, we were worried at the beginning, but it's a good thing because when this grass dies, then we know that the moisture level in the wall is good enough, is down low enough to be able to plaster it over. If it's not low enough and you plaster it, then you're going
to
end up with moisture problems in the wall.
So you have to wait for plants to die.
You have to wait for your plants to die. Yep.
And what's
yeah.
the R
value? It's about it's same as the hempcrete, about 30, yeah, or so. And the sip panels are about 40.
So
these were constructed in the same manner. And in every good straw bale house, you have some truth windows, so you can see what's behind the wall. So before we plastered, we put on a couple of windows, and then once it's finished plastering, I'll show you on the next slide. You can see what's directly behind the wall, which is a really cool thing. So this is the plaster. We used a lime plaster, so basically just lime and water. And the lime plaster worked really well for the hempcrete because the lime in the plaster adhered to the lime in the hempcrete, and that was great. It adhered, and it was perfect. Unfortunately, it was a little bit harder to get it to adhere to the slip straw surface because the minerals weren't connecting to each other very well. Eventually, it worked out fine, but it was a little more difficult. We just had to keep going over it and kind of fixing it up. There were cracks and stuff like that, but by the end it was fine. It just didn't adhere immediately like we wanted it to. And so this is what the truth windows look like at the end, which is kind of cool. So another insulative material that we used was cotton batting, and this was in between, so all the regular stick frame walls in between the straw bale panels, the east and west walls that were the load-bearing walls. Yeah, that's true. I mean, we got the straw from a farm literally down the street from where we were building, so we just put in a pickup truck and took it over. And it is, I think building with straw bale is a little bit more labor-intensive, and it's harder to find people that know how to do it properly, because the plastering especially takes a lot of time, and it's really, you really have to know what you're doing in order to do it properly. So in terms of the cost-benefit, or the difference in cost between a regular house and a straw bale house, it's pretty much the same, unless you're doing the labor yourself. You'll save a lot of money if you're doing that, but if you're not, then it's going to be pretty much the same cost.
I wonder how long.
Until we're all experts. Well, I mean, for this, like, there are 26 of us that were building this building, and we all paid to do it. Like, we weren't being paid to build a 2,000 square foot building, right? So you'll definitely
Someone's
getting free labor, exactly. Yeah, well, we had 3 to 4 weeks at the beginning just to learn a little bit about building science and what is in a building and how it's built on a not very in-depth, obviously, but a beginner's guide to it. And then we were essentially just sent out to do our jobs. And so Chris Magwood, our teacher, he was there every single day, Monday to Friday, on site to answer any questions and help with each of the steps. And then we always had meetings with him, like each person had their own task, right? So everyone had meetings with him to determine what they needed to do and what steps they needed to go through to finish their particular part of the building. So yeah, I was definitely learning on site. So no one really had an idea of what we were doing to begin with. And then we just, yeah, it's great. It's really great. Yeah, they used cotton batting on Hans and Hans?
Yeah, well, just
nice.
One time.
Oh,
he's
the program.
Actually,
I think that's when he was in California.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's really cool. I need to see that episode now. the only thing that I have a complaint about is it's really hard to cut, we found. I had to use a Japanese saw, which dulled after one cut. So I'm not entirely sure what the best material is, like what the best knife or tool is to cut it, but that's the only thing that I have a complaint for with this stuff. And also, my nose had a little bit of blue stuff in it afterwards. Oh. But other than that, it was great. Yeah, it's better than pink stuff, exactly. So the last type of wall system is the site-built straw bale wall. And this one, it didn't need any kind of framing because it's not load-bearing, and we were just kind of filling up a space, essentially. So the only framing that we put in were the window box for the two windows on the side, and there was one window and a door on the other side as well. And so basically we took a straw bale and we dipped it in our clay slip pit, which you can see in the top right-hand corner. And you can see in the lower corner, it's very messy. It's just like mud, essentially. So we were like kids playing in mud, which was really fun. So you just dip it in, and we're buttering the bales again to make sure that when we put the plaster on, that there is adherence to the straw bale. Otherwise, the plaster can just fall off, and then you have moisture problems.
Can you butter
No, we just butter two sides, two ends. Actually, we only needed to do one, really, but we did two, both sides, one on the outside, one on the inside. It just makes life much easier when you're plastering. So this was, I think it was invented, so to speak, by a French baler, like a couple of years ago, and he found that it was really, really easy to plaster, because you're plastering with your hand a lot of the time, right? So on a bale that doesn't have anything on it, a dry bale, it's actually cuts into your skin. It's really uncomfortable to work with, but when it's wet and when you already have plaster on it, it's really easy for the plaster that you're putting on to adhere to it. So it's a little bit more difficult in the beginning process, but it's much easier in the end. And so this is what it looks like before it's plastered. It looks like a hairy, hairy wall. And again, the same way that we have to stuff the SIP panels, we have to stuff inside each of the small little corners in between all the bales to make sure that everything is totally covered and filled. And then we plastered it, and you can do any kind of shapes, but we decided to do rounded windows, which is kind of characteristic of straw bale homes, and I think it's really beautiful. You can just kind of round all the openings to the windows and doors, and on the inside and the outside. And the plaster that we used was made out of our clay slip with a little bit of straw in it and a little bit of sand, and that's pretty much it. So it's really natural stuff. And then once it was done, we coated it with a silicate dispersion paint, and that adheres, the minerals adhere to each other, and then you have like a coating on it, so it's a water coating as well. I'll show you later. There's a slide for that. We actually just laid the actual wires underneath the bales. Yeah, you can do it in pipes as well. Depends.
I just wanted to ask about the windows.
Yeah, definitely. All of the windows in the building are operable. And that's really important for natural ventilation. I think a lot of buildings don't have that, and I don't really understand why you wouldn't want to have natural air flowing into your building, as opposed to having like a big HVAC or HRV system. So the floor system. We used radiant floors, and so inside the building, it was the gravel bed that we had started with on the outside of the building as well, where we put the foundation on top of. So we covered it with Tyvek, air barrier, and then vapor barrier, and then we put silver board down to act as insulation, because you need to have insulation underneath any kind of radiant floor, otherwise you're going to be heating the ground, and the ground is infinitely able to accept that heat, and so that doesn't make any sense for your building. So the way we did this was to have nine different buildings. And the reason we decided to have nine different ones is because if you only have one or two, by the time the water gets to one end of the building, it's cooled down a lot already. And so you're going to have a cold end of your building and a warm end of your building, and that obviously is not very comfortable. So we decided to have nine, and so we have like different sections of the building. And so it's always going to be an even heat around.
Heating zones?
Heating zones, yeah, essentially. So it's just going to be more even heating of the ground. And to heat the water that goes through the system, we use geothermal energy. So this was the setup here. We have a compressor, And so there's the way it works is there's it's right here. This would be what goes down to the ground, and you put a refrigerant solution or like a glycol solution in there that heats up at the temperature of the earth, which is about 10 degrees always, but once you're below the frost line, most places in the world it's about 10 degrees all year long, any time you go down there. And so essentially that stuff heats up a lot at about 10 degrees, and then once it comes up it goes through a compressor system which causes it to boil and causes it to reach a higher temperature. And then that, we have a looping system, so there's like the heated fluid in a copper pipe that loops around a copper pipe that contains water, and so the heat transfers into the water, and then the water goes into our hot water tank, and that water then goes through the radiant system. So the only negative part about a radiant floor system is that it takes up quite a bit of energy. It costs a lot to run the pump to run through constantly, because it's always running through there. But it's good because we're using geothermal energy, which is a renewable source, obviously, and you can use it for heating and cooling. So you just reverse the system for cooling, in which case the water from the building will go down to the ground and the heat will be released into the ground surface, and then cooler water will come back up. And so once we finished laying down all the pipes for the radiant floor system, we filled it with gravel, an inch or two of gravel, and then we tamped it down, and then we poured some concrete down. So we had about 2 inches of concrete over the floor surface, which acts as a thermal mass. So the radiant floor, so the water that's heated underneath that will heat up this thermal mass, that 2 or 3 inches of concrete, and that will radiate out to the building. And then on top of that, we had the girls that were in charge of the floor decided to do a really nice tile system at the front door and a mosaic in the middle of the floor as well. Yeah, that's the problem. You have to have, I mean, you could do thermal radiant walls as opposed to radiant floors as well. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to have like a thick material. So you can have like a brick wall or something, or a cob or something like that, that has a good density, mm-hmm. and that would work as well. So you could have like a wood floor system instead of concrete. And so because it's an environmental education center, we decided to finish the concrete floor with little footprints. So there's footprints all over the building of animals, and they did a really good job. They did a lot of research to find out what animals eat other animals in the environment and how things work. So it was really cute. And then they also took some plants that are around, just that they got outside, and they stamped them around the mosaic. So you can see at the top corner there. And then we finished it off with soycrete, which is a solution made from soy that just covers the floor and it treats it. And for interior framing, we used mostly steel studs, which are awesome. They're really easy to use, they're light, they're durable, and they're made from recycled steel, which is another great thing. And so these particular steel frames were used to frame in the washroom. And this is the finished washroom. And we had plumbing installed just in case the person who takes over the building. These guys had a lease for the building for 20 years, and I'm assuming they'll keep it for long after that. But just in case someone else takes over the building and they want to put actual plumbing in, like an actual toilet that runs, we had to put in some plumbing for them. But this toilet is a composting toilet. It's a Maltoa 60, that's the brand that we used. And this is basically it. It just sits right on the ground. There's no water, nothing that goes underneath it. There's mulch inside of it, and once you sit on the seat, the top of it opens, and so inside there's a mixing mechanism, so you have to plug it into the wall. And there's also a little bit of a heating mechanism, so it heats up any of the liquid, and that just evaporates up into this tube that just goes straight out. This is the roof, essentially. And then the actual solid material gets mixed up and composted, and you only have to clean it out. If you're using it to the capacity, you clean it out about once, or actually 3 to 4 times a year, and that's it. And basically you just pull out the drawer on the bottom, dump it, and put it back in. That's all you gotta do. It's great. It's a really awesome system. So if you're talking about based on the use of 5 uses per person per day, which is quite a bit actually, you can use for 4 people full-time or 6 people part-time, which is a fairly high capacity, I think. Yeah, we used recycled gypsum drywall. And then because we have no gray water, we have no black water, which is toilet water, so we have a gray water system. So the sinks in the washroom feed into this gray water purification system, which is a constructed wetland. And there's a little perforated T here, so the T pipe, so the water comes in here, and then it flows into this wetland part here, which has all the plants in it. And that goes, it has a residence time of about 2 days. And the plants don't, it doesn't really matter what the plants are, because they're not the ones that are actually doing the cleaning of the water. It's the bacteria that's in the gravel in there. So the plants were just in there for beauty's sake, pretty much, and for the kids to be able to look at and see that there's, you know, a little wetland. And another wall system inside that we used was this beautiful can wall. We built it out of, well, out of pop cans and beer cans. There was a lot of beer drinking in this summer. And beer bottles as well, wine bottles. So we basically just cut them in half and then stuck two bottle ends to each other to make like a brick. And then we just kind of stacked them. And the mortar that we used was very similar to the plaster that we used on the wall, the straw bale wall. And that's stable. You can build it up all the way to the top. And there's windows on the other side of this. Unfortunately, at this point, there's an HVAC system hanging from the ceiling that's really big. And so it blocks a lot of the sunlight, which is really unfortunate. So the lighting in the building, we had, I think, 40 lights, I believe. And the majority of them were LED lights. We found ones that don't cast a really ugly light, which some is a problem with some LED lights, but these ones are quite nice. So there's two different types of LED lights, and the other ones were compact fluorescents that we used in the office mechanical room. And for the windows that we used are very similar to this kind of thing here, fiberglass, insulated fiberglass, double glazed, and there's argon-filled, low-E glass. And they're all operable. They're the ones that you kind of crank open. And to fill in on the walls that we used hempcrete slip straw or straw bale, we actually filled it in with hempcrete instead of with foam, spray foam. Obviously, it's a much more sustainable use, and it works just the same way. And you can see on the outside, this is all the hempcrete. So you can create designs on the outside of the house and paint them a different color, and it looks really nice on the background. So we have a rainwater harvesting system. I started the talk out talking about how water is so important, and we waste a lot of that water. So we decided to have a rainwater system so that it collects all the water that falls on the gable roof, the steel roof. So we have galvanized steel drain pipes, and they all feed... This is all going to be covered eventually, but they all feed into this big rainwater cistern, which is, I think it's 3,000 gallons. And it has one system here so that the first rainfall of a particular rainfall will get flushed out, because that contains the most pollutants, if there happen to be any pollutants on the roof. That just gets flushed out, and then the rest of it falls into the cistern. And this is a pump system that pumps it into the building. And in the building, just above the constructed wetland, there's a carbon filter, two particle filters, two different sizes, and then a UV filter. And then from the UV filter, it goes into a tank, and that feeds into the sinks that we have in the building. And so it is potable. The way that we got around the code system was that because children are going to be using the building, they want to be really sure that the water is absolutely potable to drink. So once a week, you can open, well, they will be opening one of these valves here and testing the water once a week for a suite of tests. I'm not entirely sure what they're testing for. And then once every month, they're testing for another set of tests. So they're covering all their bases to make sure that the water is absolutely potable. If there were any problems with any of the tests, they would obviously shut that down. But if you don't want to have this for potable water in a home system, it's really easy to have a rainwater capture system, even just a single rain barrel. You don't have to do very much to retrofit your house for a rain barrel. And you use that to water your lawn. You can use it to flush toilets. You can use it to wash your laundry. It's very simple. It saves so much water. And it's a really good use of the water that's coming down from the sky. So the solar power system. So the bottom right picture is what makes this building a net zero energy building. It's a 4.1 kilowatt solar panels, and that the building is grid tied, so it's not off grid entirely. And I can talk about why it's more beneficial to be grid tied, especially in Ontario. So basically, there's a lot of incentives for people to produce their own energy in Ontario, and I really, really hope that starts out here as well. So I think we can do some pushing of the government for that. But basically, there's a feed-in tariff. So you, when you produce your own energy, you feed it back to the grid, and they pay you for that energy. They pay 42 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas we buy it for about 12 cents a kilowatt hour. So you're making money already. And it's going up to just over 80 cents a kilowatt hour. So once it's up to that point, the building thinks that the Kamcortha thinks they're going to make about $3,000 a year on the energy that they make. Which, so it's actually a net plus energy building as opposed to net zero.
It is purely tied
to the grid.
Isn't it also access?
No, the way the energy itself works is it just goes straight to like the path of least resistance. So it's just going to go to wherever it can go. It's connected directly
so
to the grid, but right. But you're paying
much
less. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, okay, yeah. Your return on investment for solar panels is like 30 to 40 years or something usually. So it takes a really, really long time, especially this kind of system, 4.1 kilowatt. I can't remember how much money this was, but I think it was close to like 50 grand or something. It's really expensive to buy these solar panels. And a lot of people, the problem with solar panels is that the return on investment is so slow. And I think there's a lot of things that you can say against that. Such as, I mean, you buy a car, the second you drive it off the lot, it is absolutely useless. Not useless, obviously, but you're not going to get that money back ever, right? You've lost it. So why not be able to produce your own energy and not be dependent on another energy source, which, like oil and gas, which is potentially not going to be around for very much longer, right? So, but there's only two sinks, so
right.
And it's a casual use building.
Yeah.
So for the paints, I was talking about the paints before. So for the exterior and interior wood trim and the shingles on the building, we used milk paint, which is really made out of milk, milk powder, limestone, clay, and natural pigments. And that just kind of bleeds right into the wood fibers, and it doesn't peel, it doesn't blister, it actually stains the wood, and it stays there. For the plaster, we used silicate dispersion paint or mineral paint, and it doesn't form a film, but it actually bonds to the minerals in the plaster that you put on. So it's like it petrifies, it says, and it forms into a stone-like microcrystalline coating, which repels liquid. So it's really good for buildings like this where you have a natural material that allows water vapor to go back and forth through it. So it's called a breathable wall. So you don't want to put a paint that will stop that breathability because then you'll have a lot of moisture problems. So something I should have mentioned this earlier, but I didn't. You should never put vapor barrier on a natural wall material because then you will rot the wall out and it will be dead very quickly. Because it's breathable, it allows vapor to go through evenly on both sides, and you really want that. If you put a vapor barrier on one side, you're going to end up with a barrier, and all the liquid is going to end up sticking inside the wall because it has nowhere else to go, and it'll just end up breaking down all the straw that's in the wall or any of the natural materials, and it'll crumble. And obviously, you don't want that. And on the interior walls, we used Benjamin Moore No VOC paint on the gypsum walls, and we didn't have too many of the gypsum walls, so we only bought one can of it. And we have similar type paints, like Cloverdale paint behind you on the wall there. That's also low to no VOC as well. And at the very front of the building, we built an entry shelter, which was essentially a little timber frame building. So it's really neat to see the way they're all connected through dowels. There's no actual screws or anything in here. And on top of it, this is the first ever thatch roof in Ontario. I don't think we'd ever do it again, but we collected these reeds. We collected 200 bundles of these on the side of the highway. They're just reeds that grow like in salt-rich environments on the side of the highway, and then put them on the roof, and it took forever. It was a really interesting process. It ended up turning out really beautifully, and on the top we put a little cap, a little shingle cap that matches the gable roof on the front of the building, so it's kind of like a little matching system. Yeah, it's just so time intensive because all the reeds, you have to take off the bottom fibrous part of it because that can rot. So you just want only the cellulose part of the reeds, right? So it took about 3 months to take off that fibrous part of all of those reeds. yeah. I mean, everyone was doing other things as well, so whenever we had some spare time, we'd go and do the reading. Yeah, it was intense. If you can buy, I mean, you can buy them in England and in the UK, right? Because, I mean, they do thatch roofs all the time, so you can get a skid, come in, it's all fresh, it's all ready, you just tack it up on the roof. This, we started from zero and went to 100%, so, yeah, I wouldn't do it this way again.
How is the thatch tied in?
It's tied in with zip ties, essentially. Yeah, around some strapping that's on the inside of the roof structure. So this is the final inside of the building. That's the front of the building. And that's it. Thanks. Thank you.
That was Jamie DeSimone, a young woman who has specialized in net zero building techniques. She was describing the 2,000-square-foot Camp Kawartha Environmental Center near Peterborough, Ontario. Jamie was part of a teaching project testing new and environmentally sustainable building materials and super low-energy techniques. For example, straw was used as the main insulation in the walls. Considering the huge impact of building materials on the planet, a sustainable civilization will require sustainable building techniques with low-energy requirements in both construction and the final building. This recording by Alex Smith was at the Lighthouse Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver, Canada. As a stimulus and teaching place for green building, the Lighthouse merges volunteers, young designers, and construction workers within the larger building industry. Find out more at sustainablebuildingcenter.com.
Well, I think the code needs to change. I think people need to be much more open to allowing these types of materials to be used. It's not, I mean, a lot of building inspectors, like our building inspectors in particular, we actually had a stop work order for a while, for 3 or 4 days, because they decided not to accept some of the stuff that we were doing, despite the fact that we had engineer reports and we had our architect sign and everything was set on our side. But they're really reluctant to change a lot of the time, so I think just education is something that's super important. People just need to learn that. I mean, these, like, straw bale building has been around for hundreds of years, and like cob building and rammed earth and all that stuff that is now considered like new age and a new building material. It's been around for like thousands of years, rammed earth, and the buildings are still standing.
Yeah, that's and the thing about
it. And I really think it's just like the powers that be that kind of stop the change. I think there's obviously there's a lot of people that are interested in it, right? But you can't do things against the code if you want it to stay standing and not have it had to be torn down because it's not fit, right? Yeah, education, and you need enough people to say that that's what they want, I think. Conspiracy theories. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's really a conspiracy.
And that's what we found with a lot of the people that we talked to before we found the engineer that was willing to sign off on the design. They hadn't heard of it before. They didn't know about it. When an engineer signs a design, they're responsible for what happens, right? So, I mean, a lot of people are not willing to put their name down on something that they don't fully understand and they don't really think or they don't know will last the way that you know, a big steel frame structure will last, right? So I think education is one of the most important things that we have to do. And I think that the age of... I mean, the baby boomers are coming to their point where they're getting retired, they're going to retirement and stuff, and I think there's a new generation of people that are coming out, and I think that if we educate them properly, then a lot of things can change.
Like
to tell you the truth, I think BC is a lot less advanced in the environmental movement than Ontario. And I thought, and coming from Ontario, you think BC is like the greenest province and I came out here because that's what I thought as well, right? But in terms of a lot of the policies and a lot of the incentives and stuff, they're 20 years behind Ontario.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he has really, really pushed things forward, which is awesome. So it's definitely like a policy thing, and it's definitely an education thing. Sure, yeah, I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. He was really into the project. We had two engineers, actually, and they were both really excited and really into it, and they've worked with this designer before. Chris Magwood, and Chris says that that's one of the most important things with like straw bale building and natural building is to have a good green engineer that's willing to kind of take risks, and that's what he found in this guy who's awesome. So,
And this is CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver.